Hey, Forensic Tales listeners, Courtney here. As you're probably aware, it's a campaign year, and you may encounter some political ads throughout this episode. As a podcaster, my primary revenue source to continue delivering this free content to you comes from advertisers. That said, any ad or campaign in this episode that is not delivered directly from me or using my voice is not a campaign I endorse or support. If you don't want to hear ads, you may skip them or fast forward while listening. You can also get all my content ad-free on Patreon at patreon.com/forensictales. Thank you for understanding and allowing me to continue to produce this weekly show for you. To get this episode of Forensic Tales ad-free, please visit patreon.com/forensictales.
Forensic Tales discusses topics that some listeners may find disturbing. The contents of this episode may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
It's a murder so widely talked about today. The 1996 unsolved murder of hip-hop artist Tupac Shakur. Although an arrest was recently made in the case, some people wonder if we'll ever know what happened that night in Las Vegas, and if forensic evidence can still be tested. This is Forensic Tales, episode number 220, The Murder of Tupac Shakur. Welcome to Forensic Tales. I'm your host, Courtney Fretwell Areola. Forensic Tales is a weekly true crime podcast covering real, spine-tingling stories with a forensic science twist. Some cases have been solved with forensic science, while others have turned cold. Every remarkable story sends us a chilling reminder that not all stories have happy endings. As a one-woman show, your support helps me find new compelling cases, conduct in-depth fact-based research, and produce and edit this weekly show. You can support my work in two simple ways. Become a valued patron at patreon.com/forensictales and leave a positive review. Before we get to the episode, we've got six new Patreon supporters to thank. Carly H., Mallory, Aisha, Oscar, Caroline P., and Max J. Now, let's get to the episode. Throughout the better half of the early 1990s, the name Tupac Shakur was synonymous with rap and hip-hop music in the U.S. and also worldwide. For many people, he's considered one of the most influential rappers of all time. He's had 5 number one albums, was nominated for 6 Grammy Awards, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2017. Whether you loved or hated his music, you knew the name Tupac if you lived in the 1990s. But chances are you also know about his death. Even after almost 30 years, there's a lot of mystery and unsolved questions surrounding his early and sudden death in 1996. Despite a recent arrest in 2023, the case remains unsolved today. No one's ever been convicted of his murder. And many people wonder if we will ever really know what happened to Tupac that 1996 night in Las Vegas, Nevada, or if forensic science can still be used to help solve it. After studying poetry, theater, and music in high school, Tupac Shakur got his first break in the music industry after becoming a backup dancer for the rap group Digital Underground in 1990. Less than a year later, in 1991, he released his debut solo album, Tupacalypse Now, on Interscope Records, which became certified gold after selling over 500,000 copies worldwide. But his success in the music world didn't end there. In fact, his debut album sold the least amount compared to everything that came next. So this was just the beginning of Tupac's career. In 1993, he released his second album, which really solidified his spot in the hip-hop community. The album quickly went platinum, with the top hits being I Get Around and Keep Your Head Up. On top of producing and creating music, Tupac also dabbled in movies and film. He landed his first starring role in the 1992 New York City crime thriller Juice, acting alongside Samuel L. Jackson and Queen Latifah. Then the following year, he was Janet Jackson's co-star in Poetic Justice in 1993. But Tupac's life certainly didn't start with all the fame and money he became accustomed to as an adult. In reality, his childhood could be described as anything but that. Born in June 1971 in East Harlem, New York, to a single mother, Afeni Shakur, Tupac didn't even have a fraction of the money he would have by the time he reached his 20s. Both his mom, Afeni, and biological father, William Billy Garland, had been active in the Black Panther Party in the late 1960s and 70s. And just 1 month before Tupac was born, his mom was acquitted of over 150 criminal charges in New York City for her role in the Black Panther movement. In fact, she spent most of her pregnancy with Tupac in jail. Throughout Tupac's childhood, his mom and a lot of other close family relatives struggled with drug and alcohol addiction, which made finding and holding down a job difficult. It also meant the family usually struggled financially. In 1984, Tupac and his family moved from New York City to Baltimore, Maryland, hoping for more opportunities. It was in Baltimore that Tupac attended Rolling Middle School before transferring to Baltimore School of the Arts in 10th grade. That's where his passion for poetry, acting, and music really took off. And despite his modest upbringing, he became a celebrity with more money than he probably knew what to do with, even before turning 20 years old. Tupac's money and fame didn't come without its legal troubles. In November 1993, Tupac and two of his friends were charged with sexual assault involving a woman while in New York. The woman alleged that after spending time with Tupac and a few members of his posse at a New York nightclub, he raped her inside his hotel room. On top of the rape charges, Tupac was also charged with illegally possessing a firearm after two guns were found inside the hotel room. The case took a little over 12 months to move through the system, but by December 1994, Tupac was acquitted of three counts of sodomy and the weapon charge, but he was ultimately found guilty of first-degree sexual abuse. It was also during this time that Tupac found himself as a victim, too. Just 1 month before he was convicted of sexual abuse, he was shot five times during a robbery at Quaid Studios in Times Square in November 1994. In that particular incident, Tupac was invited by music manager James Jimmy Henchman Rosemond to come to Quaid Studios to record a verse on one of his clients' songs, Little Sean. For doing the verse, they were going to pay Tupac $7,000, which, by all accounts, he needed at the time with all of his legal troubles going on. Now, initially, Tupac wasn't sure he wanted to do it. But after a little convincing, he decided he needed the money and it was only a single verse. He would be in and out of the studio in less than a few hours. So that night, Tupac and two other people showed up at Quaid Studios. But when they arrived in the lobby, three men robbed and beat Tupac at gunpoint. And when he decided to fight back, one of them pulled out a gun and shot him five separate times. Despite being shot that many times, he made a full recovery and even made it to court in a wheelchair to be sentenced on the sexual abuse charges. But pretty quickly, rumors were swirling that this was all a setup. Whoever shot Tupac knew that he was going to be there at that particular recording studio in New York, and he was only invited there so that he could be shot. There were even rumors that fellow hip-hop rapper Biggie Smalls, aka Christopher Wallace, was behind the shooting. Tupac himself evenly openly accused Biggie of having knowledge of the shooting, which Biggie and his crew adamantly denied. Before the 1994 shooting, Tupac and Biggie Smalls were considered friends. But all of that changed after the shooting. Tupac was well considered to be a West Coast rapper, while Biggie came from the East Coast. And during this 1990s hip-hop era, the two coasts were considered rivals. They also had gangs associated with them. Since Tupac was a West Coast rapper, he was considered and associated with the Bloods gang. On the other hand, Biggie Smalls, who was a mainstream talent by this point, was an East Coast rapper associated with the Crips, a rival to the Bloods. Now fast forward to September 1996. On September 7th, Tupac and Marion Shug Knight, the head of his music label Death Row, arrived in Las Vegas, Nevada. The plan was to watch the heavyweight fight between Mike Tyson and Bruce Seldon at the MGM Grand Resort. Then after the fight, they were going to go to some of Las Vegas's most popular nightclubs. Pretty much everywhere Tupac went, he had a posse or an entourage with him. Bodyguards, fans, friends, family members, girlfriends, and fiancés, fellow rappers, and music artists. Tupac and Suge Knight always traveled with a posse, and this particular trip to Las Vegas was no different. So around 8:30 p.m. on the 7th, Tupac and his entourage, including Suge Knight, took their front row seats at the MGM Grand Garden Arena, a very popular venue for these types of big fights. But the fight was over within 2 minutes, with Mike Tyson winning in a first-round knockout. By 8:40 p.m., Tupac is seen giving Mike Tyson a hug after his win. The two were said to be close friends. About 10 minutes later, around 8:50 p.m., Tupac, Suge Knight, and the rest of their group were caught on casino surveillance cameras getting into a fight with a group of guys in the hotel's lobby right outside the fight arena. Later on, two of the men identified in the fight were Dwayne Keefe D. Davis and his nephew, Orlando Anderson, both members of the Southside Compton Crips, and two people Tupac had gotten into altercations with in the past. Surveillance videos showed Tupac and Suge Knight kicking and punching Orlando Anderson near a bank of elevators. The fight was allegedly about another altercation that happened a few months earlier in July, where Orlando Anderson and a few fellow gang members assaulted Trayvon Lane, an employee of Death Row Records, and during this altercation, the group attempted to steal his Death Row medallion. There were also rumors that there had been a bounty placed on Death Row medallions by their rivals, the Compton Crips, the gang that Orlando Anderson was a member of. So when Tupac and Suge Knight saw Anderson and his uncle, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, at the MGM in Las Vegas that night after the fight, they got into an altercation about the alleged stolen Death Row medallion from a few months earlier. And at this time, tensions between Tupac and his Death Row entourage and the Southside Compton Crips were basically at an all-time high. Anytime their paths crossed, it was almost guaranteed that a fight would break out. But this incident was more like a jumping than a fight. Since Orlando Anderson was practically by himself and Tupac had several other guys with him, Anderson didn't stand a chance. At least five of Tupac's friends were seen beating Anderson up. They kicked him, they punched him, and by the time everything was over, he was practically beaten to a pulp. The fight was eventually broken up, and surveillance cameras continued to follow Tupac as he made his way through the casino lobby. It's very clear from the videos that Tupac is really upset about what happened. So naturally, The hotel's security team wanted to follow him and see if there would be another fight. But there wasn't, at least not inside MGM. That's because, 3 hours later, Tupac was shot and killed. No one really knows what exactly happened between 9 p.m. and 11 p.m. after Tupac left the MGM Grand that night. If we did, Tupac's murder likely still wouldn't be unsolved. But here's what we do know. Hey, Forensic Tales listeners, Courtney here. Do you hate listening to ads? Well, you can listen to every single episode of this show ad-free through Patreon, starting for just $3 a month. And what's great? You don't have to change how you listen. You can still enjoy ad-free episodes of Forensic Tales through most podcast apps. As a patron, you'll also get other great perks, like weekly bonus episodes. This is where I give you my reaction to each week's story that I don't share in regular episodes. But more importantly, your support means I can continue to deliver high-quality weekly true crime stories. Don't forget, Forensic Tales is just a one-woman show. If you're interested in learning more, go to patreon.com/forensictales. That's patreon.com/forensictales. There's also a link in the show notes. Now, back to the episode. We know Tupac and his crew left the MGM Grand after getting into a fight with Orlando Anderson around 9. The plan was to go to a few of Vegas's nightclubs for the rest of the night, one of them being Club 662, where they had a scheduled appearance. Based on both surveillance videos and interviews with people who were with him that night, we know Tupac first ended up at the Luxor Hotel and Casino across the street from the MGM. The Luxor Hotel was where Tupac's fiance was staying. After they hung out around the Luxor for a while, Tupac left and headed to one of Suge Knight's houses, which he owned in Las Vegas. This is where the group went to, quote, pre-party before going to the clubs. By all accounts, everything seemed normal up until this point. Everything was fine besides the fight with Orlando Anderson back at the MGM. And there was no indication that anything bad was about to happen to Tupac that night or anyone in his crew. Now, for me and you, a fight with someone like Orlando Anderson probably wouldn't be described as a quote-unquote normal night. It just wouldn't. But for Tupac and his friends, it was normal. A lot of people he hung out with were known gang members. And Tupac had his fair share of enemies. So did people like Suge Knight, the owner of Death Row Records. So for them, this was an ordinary night. A fight wouldn't be out of the question. And after it happened, they all just went about the rest of their nights. Around 11 p.m., Tupac left Suge Knight's house and got into Knight's black BMW. Knight was driving and Tupac was in the passenger seat. Then behind them were a few of their friends in separate cars, including Tupac's bodyguard. Now, this situation was a little unusual. Normally, Tupac's bodyguard was always with him and they traveled in the same car. But this night was different. The only two people in that black BMW were Tupac and Knight. Suge Knight, again, was the driver and Tupac was the passenger. And his bodyguard was in one of the cars behind them. But they were all headed to the nightclub. Sometime while driving down the Las Vegas Strip, the police pulled over Suge's BMW. The cops told them they were playing their music too loud and needed to turn it down. They also got on him for not correctly displaying the car's license plate. But the cops didn't give Knight or Tupac a ticket or anything. They probably knew who they were and decided to let them go with just a warning. They also found the license plate inside of the car's trunk, and after that, the two of them continued their drive down Las Vegas Boulevard. At about 11:15 p.m., the BMW stopped at a stoplight at Flamingo Road in Colville Lane, a block from the Strip. One of Tupac's friends, Malcolm Greenridge, who was in a car behind them, said some women in a car pulled up to the passenger side of the BMW where Tupac was sitting. He watched as Tupac and the girls talked for a few seconds, and Malcolm Greenridge said that he just assumed Tupac was inviting them to the club too. It wouldn't be the first time he met girls like that and invited them to join their posse. So that's what he assumed was happening. After Tupac and the other car chatted for less than a minute, the girls drove away while Tupac and Knight were still stopped at a red light. Seconds later, a white Cadillac did a U-turn and pulled up by Tupac's side of the car. At this point, most of Tupac's entourage, who were following in separate cars, including his bodyguard, had already passed them, leaving Tupac and Knight completely alone. As soon as the white Cadillac made the U-turn and pulled up next to the BMW, someone inside the car pulled out a gun and started firing in Tupac's direction. In total, more than a dozen gunshots were fired, and Tupac was hit by four of them. Two of them had hit him right in the center of his chest. According to one of Tupac's bodyguards, who was in a separate car and witnessed part of the shooting, the gunman was seated in the back seat. So after the driver pulled up next to the BMW, whoever was seated in the back seat rolled down their window and started shooting at them. The bodyguard also recalled that there were multiple people inside that white Cadillac. After more than a dozen shots were fired, the Cadillac sped away while someone in Tupac's entourage pulled out a gun of their own and started shooting at them, but they were able to get away. Tupac's friend, Suge Knight, was also injured in the drive-by shooting, but unlike Tupac, he was hit by only bullet fragments. And even though one of the bullets grazed his head, he wasn't seriously hurt in the incident. Tupac, on the other hand, was severely injured. Paramedics transported Tupac to the University Medical Center in Vegas at 11:20 p.m., just minutes after the call came into the police about the shooting. At first, there was hope that he would pull through. At the time he arrived at the hospital, he was still alive, and a lot of people thought he would make it. He was Tupac, after all. He'd been shot before and survived. Why wouldn't he be able to do it again? But this time was different. Two of the bullets hit Tupac directly in the chest, and despite being in a medically induced coma, he didn't survive. Tupac Shakur, the hip-hop music legend and icon, was pronounced dead 6 days later on September 13th. He was just 25 years old. In the midst of all the chaos, the police didn't know who the victims or suspects were when they first got to the scene where Tupac was shot. So a lot of people in the entourage were initially treated as suspects because no one knew who the gunman was. Most of them were ordered out of their cars at gunpoint until the police could figure out exactly who was who. And that's when they found out that whoever the gunman was long gone from the scene, and everyone else there was someone Tupac knew or was a part of his group that night. Naturally, the first people the cops wanted to speak to were these people. However, according to the lead detective from the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, none of these people were very cooperative with the investigation. Although Tupac was their friend, none of these people had a good perception or relationship with police officers. Most of these people came from a culture that really distrusted law enforcement, so no one really wanted to help when it came to the investigation. Yes, they wanted to figure out who shot and killed their friend Tupac, but they didn't want to help the police, so it was kind of a strange contradiction. On the one hand, you've got the police trying to interview these people and find potential witnesses so they could basically figure out who did this. And on the other hand, you've got a group of people who simply don't trust the police, and they're perfectly fine going out and finding the shooter themselves and taking care of things that way. So right from the very beginning, the Las Vegas police didn't have much to work with, since most of the witnesses who were there that night didn't want to cooperate. The only person the cops spoke to who seemed to want to cooperate was a guy named Yaki Fula, a 19-year-old rapper who had been in the car directly behind Tupac when he was shot. He told the officers that night that he might be able to identify the driver of the car that pulled up alongside Tupac and Suge Knight's car if he saw him again. He didn't get a good look at the shooter, but he thought he recognized the driver of the car. He also said it was a white Cadillac. But besides him, no one in the entourage really provided the police with much. 2 days after the shooting, a police informant claimed two members of the Crip gang had been spotted driving a white Cadillac matching the description to a stereo shop in Compton, California, a few hundred miles away from Las Vegas. Not only was this a good tip because it was a similar-looking vehicle, but according to some of the witnesses from the night of the shooting, someone in Tupac's group shot at the vehicle as it drove away. So the theory was maybe someone was taking the Cadillac to a body shop repair shop to basically repair the bullet hole damage. But unfortunately, this tip was never followed up by the Las Vegas police. According to a news article by Sky News, the Las Vegas police didn't trust the Compton, California police because of past corruption scandals. So we basically have no idea if this was the same vehicle used in the shooting or not. Over the next 2 months, not much happens in the investigation until November. On November 10th, 1996, the police's main witness, 19-year-old rapper Yaki Fula, was shot and killed outside a New Jersey apartment complex. Remember, he was one of the few people cooperating with the police who was in the car directly behind Tupac and witnessed the shooting. And now, he was mysteriously shot and killed. Tupac's murder in 1996 certainly wasn't the only one to rock the hip-hop community. Less than a year later, another very famous rapper was gunned down. Biggie Smalls, aka Christopher Wallace, Tupac's one-time friend turned rival. On March 9, 1997, 24-year-old Biggie Smalls was shot dead in a drive-by shooting while leaving a party in Los Angeles, California. And like Tupac, his murder still remains unsolved today, leaving many people to wonder if the two murders were related. The biggest clue the police had about Tupac's murder was the fight that broke out right after the Mike Tyson fight at the MGM Grand. The one between Tupac and Orlando Anderson over the alleged stolen Death Row medallion. It just seemed like too much of a coincidence that a fight like that happens, and then Tupac is shot and killed less than 3 hours later. So naturally, the first suspect was Orlando Anderson. He was widely believed to have been the passenger who shot Tupac. There were even rumors that he bragged about the shooting afterward to fellow gang members. And that wouldn't be too surprising if that was true. If Orlando Anderson really was the gunman, he would definitely want to brag about it. He would be given a tremendous amount of street cred for being the guy behind killing Tupac. On the flip side, however, he would have also become a huge target for people to looking to seek revenge for what happened. So what happened to Orlando Anderson, and why was he never arrested? Well, about 1 month after the shooting, Anderson and 21 other alleged gang members were detained in Compton, California, and questioned about Tupac's murder. But only a few days later, the Las Vegas police told the media they didn't consider Anderson a suspect. However, it's unclear why, because by all accounts, he seemed to be the prime suspect in everything. A year later, Tupac's mom, Afeni Shakur, filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Anderson despite never being charged in the case. In response to that lawsuit, Anderson filed his own against Death Row Records, the music label owned by Suge Knight that signed Tupac. His lawsuit sought damages for injuries resulting from that fight at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. He also wanted to be compensated for the emotional distress and trauma he experienced from the beating. Of course, he continued to deny having involvement in the deadly shooting. Both lawsuits were eventually settled, and according to Anderson's attorney, his settlement awarded Anderson about $78,000. In September 1997, Anderson sat down for an interview for the Los Angeles Times. And in the interview, he denied having any involvement in the shooting. He even said he was a fan of Tupac's music, so why would he want him dead? Despite the rumors that the shooting was revenge for the fight that happened earlier that night. But before Anderson could ever be questioned by detectives again, he was also killed. On May 29th, 1998, Orlando Anderson was killed in a drug-related shootout at a Compton car wash. He was 23 years old. And whatever secrets he had about Tupac's murder went to the grave with him. Another prime suspect over the years is Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, Orlando Anderson's uncle, who was also in Las Vegas and believed to be in that white Cadillac. In October 2011, LAPD detective Greg Kading, who was the lead detective assigned to the investigation into the murder of Biggie Smalls, released a book alleging Sean Diddy Combs commissioned Dwayne Davis to kill Tupac and Suge Knight for $1 million. In the book, Kading alleges that during a taped conversation with Davis, he admitted his nephew, Orlando Anderson, was the gunman, and that he was in the car with him. The story went like this. Four men, including Anderson and Davis, were in the white Cadillac that pulled up alongside Knight's BMW. Anderson was in the back seat and shot Tupac by leaning out the back window, all because the men were offered $1 million to do it. But whether it was by Sean Diddy Combs or not is still up for debate. Some detectives said it was Diddy, and others said it was someone else. Now, the reason why Dwayne Davis even came up on the LAPD detective Craig Kading's radar was because he was investigating Biggie Smalls' murder in LA. Davis had been at the party at the Peterson Automotive Museum that Biggie Smalls had just left before he was shot. And during his police interview, he allegedly also answered questions about Tupac's murder. But here's a big deal right here. Davis was supposedly granted some type of immunity of everything he said about Tupac's murder. So that's why he was never arrested back then. Well, many years later in 2018, Dwayne Davis was featured in a BET documentary called Death Row Chronicles. This was shortly after he received what he described as a terminal cancer diagnosis. In the documentary, he admitted to being in the front passenger seat of the Cadillac. He said the car was driven by Terrence Brown, while DeAndre Smith and his nephew Orlando Anderson were in the back seat. Now, on a side note, all three of them, Brown, Smith, and Orlando Anderson, have all since died before the documentary even aired. Dwayne Davis was the only one who was inside of the car that's still alive. When Davis was asked point blank who shot and killed Tupac, he simply smiled and said, quote, "Gonna keep it for the code of the streets. It just came from the back seat, bro," end quote. After that, Dwayne Davis never really stopped talking about the shooting. In his tell-all memoir called Compton Street Legend, he talked even more about his involvement. He even added that after the shooting, he and the other suspects, quote, "partied like it was any other night," End quote. They weren't even fazed by what happened. Now, you're probably wondering if Dwayne Keefe D. Davis had said this all over these years, has said it many times about his involvement, why wasn't he arrested years ago? Why is Tupac's murder still considered quote-unquote unsolved? Well, fast forward to 2023. In July 2023, the Las Vegas police executed a search warrant on Davis's house, looking for evidence that tied him to the shooting. Despite the fact that it had been decades, they received information that evidence connected to the murder might still be in Davis's possession. And if that was true, they might finally have enough to make an arrest. According to ABC News, some of the items taken from Davis's house included a computer, hard drives, and magazine articles about Tupac's death, all items possibly containing digital forensic evidence. This search was the biggest update in the case in many, many years. Up until July 2023, very little progress was made in the investigation. And no one really knew if the Las Vegas police were even still investigating Tupac's murder. So when this story hit the news, it came as a really big shock. Then came another shock, an even bigger one. About 2 months after the search, in September 2023, now 60-year-old Dwayne Keefe D. Davis was indicted by a Clark County, Nevada grand jury on one count of murder with the use of a deadly weapon with a gang enhancement for his involvement in Tupac's murder. And the very next day, he was taken into police custody while out on a walk near his home in Nevada. According to the grand jury reports, there was enough evidence to try him for the murder, even going as far as to say that he was the one who plotted it. After almost 30 years, this marked the first time anyone had been arrested in Tupac's case. Detectives investigating the murder said they had been, quote, reinvigorated by the information Davis had provided to the media in interviews around the release of his memoirs. Even though the police believe that four people were inside that white Cadillac, only Dwayne Davis can be charged with the murder. That's because, like I mentioned earlier, the other three men are all dead, so the authorities will have to settle on him. So what do they have against him, and what does the forensic evidence tell us? Well, most of the evidence is Davis's own words being used against him. Investigators say he actually confessed to the shooting, giving the cops full details of how he and the other three men killed Tupac. But the interview was in exchange for some other information involving the shooting death of Biggie Smalls. And he was given full immunity for everything he said during that interview relating to Tupac's murder. Well, since he didn't stop talking after that police interview, everything he said afterward wasn't covered under this immunity deal. So everything he said in documentaries, podcasts, even his own book over the years was basically free game for investigators to consider as evidence, essentially meaning the police and prosecutors can use his own words against him when he describes his role in the murders in TV and podcasts. Now, as far as forensic evidence goes, when the police executed the search warrant on his house in Henderson, Nevada, they seized multiple computers, hard drives, and photos. But the exact contents of these items aren't known. Nothing about what they found from the search has been made public, at least not yet. So we have no idea what was found or what the police believe was on those hard drives and computers. But if you ask Dwayne Davis's defense attorney, they will say there is no forensic evidence against their client. According to them, The police and prosecutors have basically nothing. No gun, no witnesses, and no car. That white Cadillac was never found. And the gun used to shoot Tupac wasn't recovered either. If they had, the police might have been able to trace them back to Dwayne Davis. Maybe there would be fingerprints on the gun. Something might have been recovered from inside or outside the white Cadillac. But again, that didn't happen. Now, going back to the prosecutors, they don't seem bothered by the lack of forensic evidence in the case. They believe a jury will still be able to find him guilty even without it. The circumstantial evidence about Davis's own words are probably enough to convince a jury that he's guilty even all of these years later. So what about a motive? Well, according to the prosecutors, the motive is pretty simple. After Tupac and his entourage jumped and beat Orlando Anderson at the MGM Grand after the Mike Tyson fight that night, Dwayne Davis and his group of fellow gang members sought retaliation. When Tupac and his crew went to the Luxor and eventually Suge Knight's house before heading to the nightclubs, prosecutors believe Davis went back to get his gun. Let's not forget, Dwayne Davis is Orlando Anderson's uncle, and both of them are members of a rival gang who've had multiple run-ins with Tupac and his entourage over the last several months. So there's already a lot of tension there besides the fight earlier that night. After Davis and the other men went to go get their guns, they simply waited for Tupac to show up at the club. But after waiting at the 662 club for a while, the crew grew tired and decided to go out looking for him. So they drove around Las Vegas Boulevard for a while until they finally spotted Suge Knight's black BMW. That's when they pulled up alongside the car at a red light, and someone from the back seat, most likely Orlando Anderson, started shooting. That was it. It was all about retaliation and two gangs clashing. They drove away, and Tupac died from his injuries a few days later. Although prosecutors have Davis's own words to use against him, this by no means is an open and shut case. It's been over 27 years since the shooting happened. There are over 600 pages of grand jury transcripts to go through. Who knows how much evidence they have and what evidence has been destroyed over the years? Under Nevada law, prosecutors only need to show that Davis aided and abetting the murder of Tupac. That would be enough to finally get a conviction. Since his arrest, Dwayne Keefe D. Davis has denied any real involvement in Tupac's murder, despite what he said in the past. And it's unclear whether his case will go to trial or not. And if it does, a trial date hasn't been set, at least not at the time of this recording. Currently, he's housed in a Nevada jail. It may have taken almost three decades for there finally to be an arrest in the murder of Tupac Shakur. But the story isn't over yet. Will prosecutors have enough evidence to get a conviction? Is there enough evidence, including forensic evidence, to convince a jury Dwayne Keefe D. Davis orchestrated the shooting? Or, after 27 years, will the only living suspect be found innocent? And the murder of Tupac Shakur will still remain unsolved. To share your thoughts on the story, be sure to follow the show on Instagram and Facebook. To find out what I think about the case, sign up to become a patron at patreon.com/forensictales. After each episode, I release a bonus episode where I share my personal thoughts and opinions about the case. Don't forget to subscribe to Forensic Tales so you don't miss an episode. We release a new episode every Monday. If you love the show, consider leaving us a positive review or tell friends and family about us. You can also help support the show through Patreon. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Please join me next week we'll have a brand new case and a brand new story to talk about. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings. Forensic Tales is a Rockefeller Audio production. The show is written and produced by me, Courtney Fretwell Areola. For a small monthly contribution, you can help create new compelling cases for the show, help fund research, and assist with production and editing costs. For supporting the show, you'll become one of the first to listen to new ad-free episodes and snag exclusive show merchandise not available anywhere else. To learn about how you can support the show, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/forensictales, or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also support the show by leaving a positive review or telling friends and family about us. Forensic Tales is a podcast made possible by our Patreon producers, Tony A., Christine B., Sherry A., Michael D., Nicola, Jerry M., Brian W., Megan G., Ureli, Jerry, Ann F., Ken S., and Carol A. If you'd like to become a producer of the show, head over to our Patreon page, or send me an email at Courtney@ForensicTales.com to find out how you can become involved. For a complete list of sources used in this episode, please visit ForensicTales.com. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings.